Hey everyone, welcome back to Rising Giants. On this week's episode, we have Thomas Shings. He is the general manager of RGX. RGX is Cambodia's first licensed digital asset exchange. Thomas is also a senior fund manager at Royal Group of Companies and was previously the head of research at the Association of Banks in Cambodia. We really hope you enjoyed tuning into this episode, talking a lot about the overall regulation around financial technology in Cambodia and what it's like, you know, building in a new industry. If you're listening in on your podcast apps, please don't forget to give us a review, whether you're on Apple, Google, Spotify, wherever you're listening. We really appreciate it. And thanks for tuning in for another week of Rising Giants. Okay, Thomas, welcome to Rising Giants. Thanks for coming on the show. Wanted to start things off by just talking about your early years, kind of how you got to where you are today. So if you could talk a little bit about some of your early career and before you ended up coming to Cambodia.
Thank you, Max and Dom, for having me today, first of all. Yeah, how do I come to Cambodia? I mean, as most people, I think, who live here, was just at some point fell in love with it and tried to stay here, tried to make a living. I'm happily saying that I got lucky enough to make it work. But how did I get here? So I grew up in Germany with my parents and one brother. Always had an interest, a curiosity for something else, like to see the world. I always wanted to go out there. So I always actually wasn't stupid, but I was quite bad in school. Always being, the teachers like to say, I was a clown. So my grades weren't always great. Had really good math grades. And I mean, I still ended up in finance. That makes sense. But like, for example, my English and French classes had really bad grades. And then one day, I think I was 15, I went to my parents and asked them if I would pay for Chinese lessons. And they were like, what the hell? You don't even manage to learn English and French, but whatever. So they paid me some Chinese lessons, started to learn Chinese. And when I was 18, when I got my diploma, we had the diploma handover, basically the prom. In Germany, we don't call it prom, but basically the same thing. And the next day, literally, I was sitting on a plane to Shanghai, and where I attended language school. From then on, so I went to Shanghai for 3 months, learned Chinese, which was like eye-opening to me in the first place. So I was 18, just finished high school, never been outside Europe. And I touched down in Shanghai at the airport. Chinese driver from the school was picking me up, didn't speak a single word in English. And then got into the van and like literally for one hour, you just drive on this elevated highway, 20 meters up from the actual roads down, going into the city of Shanghai and just skyscrapers left and right. And this was an eye-opening moment for me in terms of like the world is huge out there, and actually like you yourself are so small as well. And there's so much to see and experience. So say 3 months there, then went back to Europe, where I started going to university. I studied mostly international business, later specialization in finance in Maastricht, so in the Netherlands. A lot of people probably won't know, Maastricht is actually the country where the Maastricht treaties, which actually founded Europe. So Maastricht is it's an important city for European history, right in the center of Europe. So that's where I studied. Did a semester in Singapore, did another study program in China. And every summer break, I tried to travel around. So I did a lot in the Middle East, like Jordan, Israel, Morocco, did a lot of hiking. So I always was an outdoorsy guy as well. So I went backpacking in Morocco by myself, did Mount Toubkal, always solo. And did the same then in Asia, traveled through all of Southeast Asia, spent a lot of time in Indonesia, did all the volcanoes there. But along that path, eventually came by Cambodia as well. And like typical backpacker thing, 2 days in Phnom Penh and like 5-6 days in Siem Reap, seeing the temples. And the genuity of the people, which was really standing out compared to a lot of other countries. People were super nice. That was like in the West, it's always the big holiday countries, obviously Thailand. And people tell this is the country of smile. But compared to that, really Cambodia is a true country of smile, actually a genuine smile. And it's not about, there's no hassling about prices. People are genuinely friendly, want to share their culture with you and say hello left and right. And kids screaming friendly on the street when you walk by and stuff. So that, besides obviously the weather and the nature, the usual stuff we just don't have. Me for in Germany, or I think you both guys English, so we don't have that in Germany or in Europe, right? Having 30 degrees all year round is also a plus. So yeah, I fell in love with Cambodia and went back studying, and always knew like I want to go to Asia, I want to see the world, want to work outside in the developing countries as well, and a little bit adventure. But also like I can't go here without finishing my school. It's like, what do I gonna do? I don't want to teach English for the next 30 years. So I pushed myself, went back and actually finished my master in finance. I finished that when I was 23. And that's basically when I went full-time, left Europe. Yeah, that's how I got here in a nutshell.
Thank you for that. Yeah, we definitely agree that Cambodia has this very genuine positivity about the people here. So that's really nice to hear as well. What would you say some of the big perceptions people have of Cambodia that are outdated at this point, and that when you explain to your friends back home or about what it's like living in Cambodia, what are they kind of misunderstanding?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the most widespread disbeliefs is just like it's a third world country, which means it's poor, it's dangerous, it's dirty. I mean, it's not a rich, developed country. It's definitely not, but it's not dangerous at all. I think this is one of the biggest misconceptions about Cambodia. I would be more scared in Europe, and I know a lot of my American friends, English friends, French friends, they all feel the same. It's more dangerous to walk around at night in Paris or in Boston or also in Germany, in Berlin, where I'm from also. Cambodia is extremely safe. The city itself is mostly very clean. There are some things, single-use plastics definitely is an issue, but it's not as dirty as some other developing countries in Africa or so. So, and again, the genuine people, it's just people think that in a developing country, dangerous, everybody might want to scam you. Everybody wants your money. You couldn't have a genuine relationship with the other gender or with any person, build a friendship or something. And I think this is a big misconception that every country, doesn't matter the economic status, has the ups and downs for different kind of people, has poor people, has rich people. And I mean, the average might be different, but I think like for all the countries I've seen in the world, where it always comes down to the same ingredients, and they like people are the same everywhere, and you got rich and poor people everywhere. Everybody just tries to protect the family, and you can make friends everywhere. So I think that's a bit misconception about Cambodia and developing countries in general. Yeah.
Okay. And what was it like your first few years working in Cambodia? We noticed that you spent some time teaching at universities. What was that experience like? And what did you learn from like the youth of Cambodia and the next wave of innovators?
I mean, I think throughout my career in Cambodia, the big adjustment is always cultural. So when I started teaching, it works differently here than in Europe. So I also taught in back in my university in Maastricht quite a bit. So tutoring courses in accounting and finance, and same what I did here, it was business, banking, and accounting. Like you really like Cambodians, extremely hierarchical. So they want the teacher to speak, and they want to absorb the knowledge the teacher is presenting. And this means that they barely ask questions, and sometimes there is a lack of criticism, but it also means that they are very curious in terms of the teacher has to really give them the knowledge and present full on. So which reflects that like you really in Cambodia, you really have to outline your lessons. You really have to plan ahead and really have a content ready, which you're going to transfer to the students. Well, in Europe, you could just go into a classroom and have a little case study and then start a more interactive session. So that's that was one of my main differences for me seeing here teaching. But yeah, my teaching stint, to be fair, was only, I think, 6 months.
What was it that you were teaching?
Accounting and banking.
Okay. Yeah. And that's definitely becoming a more popular career choice for Cambodians.
Yes. I mean, I think from all the universities in Cambodia and like the also international accreditations, the number one thing currently for Cambodians, I think, is accounting. So you can study an internationally recognized ACCA. By now you have CFA Institute, Chartered Financial Analyst. Yes, and one big other thing is legal. So you have Royal University of Law and Economics. Yeah, so I mean, this is exactly my field as well. Unfortunately for the country, where we hope that they diversify a bit more, so there should be a bit more. I know like the last few years, we're definitely putting a lot more effort into digitalization, so there's now a lot more coding schools. Just recently, Hunmanet went to France and they signed an MOU on building a coding school for Cambodians. So I hope eventually there might be also more of engineering, for example, electronics, stuff like this. But yeah.
Is there any like area of study that you think if you could really push on that would have a big impact? Would it be something like sort of the more mechanical side of engineering, not the software?
Yeah, I think it's both. I mean, it's like Cambodia has become such an incubator for technology, right? So that like the digitization and leapfrogging, I mean, I don't really like that word's been used too often, but Cambodia really is like has so many still undeveloped areas in the economy, which they now can gap thanks to technology, be it in banking, being in food deliveries, being in deliveries in general, in social media, anything. So they immediately go to digitization way, right? So I think it's extremely important to have this software affinity youth and having those coders and teaching coding. But in the long term, for a really diversified economy, a real economy, and we recently had Ford setting up an assembly line, I think around Pusat. We have Toyota currently building a plant in the special economic zone. And I mean, those are great developments. And for Cambodia to go down that route, to become more diversified and really also build things instead, not just agricultural goods, but actually build something. And so currently it's all agriculture and garments, but to actually build stuff, I think it would be good to the next step after digitalization will also add engineering, mechanical engineering, construction, things like this.
Yeah. And, you know, taking a look at the timeline too. So during the time that you were lecturing at these business schools too, that's when you were also working as the head of research for the Association of Banks in Cambodia, or the ABC. What was it like working there, and how did you feel like your learnings were able to translate as well to the lecturing part of your career as well?
Yeah. So, I mean, I did both for just a short time. I said maybe a couple months that I actually did both at the same time. But I ended up being with ABC for 5 years. So for 5 years, I worked for the banks, representing the bank's interest to the National Bank of Cambodia and other authorities. I think the biggest lesson I personally had, which still allows me to actually operate and be in Cambodia, is to understand the culture and to adjust my own attitude and behavior. Because as a German, I was raised also by, my dad is an engineer, by very straightforward people, never putting a hand for the mouth and like really talking straight and being honest and being critical. So that is something I had to adjust a little bit in terms of hierarchy plays a much more important role here in Cambodia. And so I had to culturally adjust to learn that where's my place to talk and when can I talk and who should I talk to. And that sometimes forums are not always there just to exchange, but just to present what was already decided to say that. But yeah, so the cultural adjustment, I think, was the biggest learning curve for me. I think this took me probably 2 years to actually understand the culture and a lot of the etiquette also in terms of, also along that way, improving on my Khmer, just having the little etiquettes like Chumip Suor and Idodom, Lukning Slay, Oknia, etc. So that you just can greet people in their local language and show them the appropriate respect. And I think this cultural learning curve was the most important thing, which helped me to be where I am now as well. Yeah.
When you're during that time, as you were learning the language, what was your general feeling of that confidence level in speaking in a business setting? Like, was there a time where you felt like it was just a light switch and you were able to, it just, everything just kind of flowed? Or was it was one of those, you know, was it just progressively you were able to gain more confidence and be able to, you know, essentially speak in those settings in Khmer?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely some form of progression. I'm still far away from being totally fluent, especially in a business setting. So, I mean, even every Khmer can tell you that Cambodian is a very difficult language. And like even your average Cambodian will not be able to talk law if he hasn't studied law. And this goes for a lot of technical sectors. They have a very specific vocabulary for each sector, and especially for those formal sectors. So yeah, sadly, I'm working on it, but my Khmer is not at, like I said, I have a master in finance, but I could not write the same exam in Khmer. There's absolutely no way. But yeah, there definitely was a progression to having the fluency and the feeling confident enough, having the confidence to just launch a certain speech or to conversation with Chomipsu and going through the etiquette in Khmer and then apologizing why I don't speak enough Khmer to keep the conversation going in Khmer, which yeah, definitely eventually became more natural and that helped a lot to open up with the Khmer as well and with the local culture. So yeah.
Fantastic. And so during the time that you were working at ABC, it was right at the end of 2017 through to 2022. And of course, during that time, there was COVID and a lot of changes within the banking sector. If you could touch on maybe just the overall growth and how maybe some of the key changes that you saw during those 5 years, four to five years, yeah, that you felt like were very much very like basically the biggest like foundation shifters, you would say, over those 5 years.
I mean, the growth has been massive in the financial sector in Cambodia over the last 10 years. So like pre-COVID, the economy was growing at 7%. Currently, we are around 5.5%, or NBC says we are back to 6.5%. But the banking sector over the last 10, 15 years was growing at 20% each year, to put that into perspective. So basically tripling doubling every 3 years in size. One of the biggest changes I saw was just the number of banks. So since I got here in 2017, people were always saying consolidation should be happening at some point, more and more banks coming. Until today, it hasn't happened. Until today, there's still basically one or two banks joining the market every year. There's still licenses being issued. I think one of the most significant things I was lucky enough to see along and to go through with as well and to work on directly, biggest shifts was the promotion of Khmer Real. So in 2017, when I started working at ABC, the real economy was around 10-15% Khmer Real, but in the financial sector, it was only 1%, less than 1% of banks' portfolios were in Khmer Real. And so end of 2017, the NBC came out and said all banks need to have 10% of a loan portfolio in Khmer Real. And this was a massive shift. Until then, a lot of the banks, especially a lot of the foreign banks, didn't have ATMs who could disperse Khmer Real. They often didn't even have accounts in Khmer Real, denominated Khmer Real accounts. They were all just 100% US dollar. And now they all had to overnight shift to Khmer Real or adopt Khmer Real and offer Khmer Real to their customers. So that was a dramatic shift and really interesting. How does a country, a dollarized country, transition or try to transition to their own currency without the possibility of hyperinflation, which had happened in Vietnam and in Thailand at some point? So not to repeat was the history of like neighboring countries, right? So that was very interesting. And I think the NBC managed that one very well. So we currently, from like less than 1%, we are now at like 12% Khmer Real in the financial sector. And Khmer Real is still pretty much pegged to the US dollar at 4,100. So that was very interesting shift in Cambodia, in the economy, also in the power for the government, because now they can actually take monetary mechanisms to help the economy in times of need, which previously they could not, right? If you're in a dollarized country, the only ones who are able to print the dollar is the US Fed. So now having 10% of the economy or 12% in Khmer Real, they actually have a little bit of leverage and actually some tools at hand that they can work with. So that's very impressive and very distinctive change and very quite unique in the world, like currently. Yeah.
Just one quick follow-up there. A lot of people mention that when describing the peg, most people will say it's, they won't say it with 100% certainty that it's pegged. So I'm curious on like your perspective on that. Like how does the pegging actually work in practice?
Yeah. So yeah, it's true. It's not 100% pegged because it's not backed by US dollar, right? But the NBC makes sure that it basically moves alongside the US dollar. So how they do that is especially over the last years, when the economy didn't do so well, the Khmer real actually lost in value and they're increasing, they're basically inflationary towards the dollar and the exchange rate increased. So what they do is they take US dollar they have, so from their own reserves, and go on the market and buy Khmer real. So basically increasing the demand for Khmer real by taking Khmer real out of the market, spending their own money, and thereby deflating the Khmer real. So I think like 6 months ago or three, four, 5 months ago, the last time NBC did a move like that was, I think that they bought back around $150 million. So yeah, that's what they do in order to keep the Khmer real stable. They have to go out and spend their own reserves and actually spend money to stabilize the market.
Hmm. Okay. And over the long term, what would you say the goal is on de-dollarization in general?
I mean, what the goal truly is, I can't speak for the government. What I can see, I believe that the government is very smart, that it doesn't make sense to push this too quick, because when you just enter hyperinflation or you're pushing a lot of actors, also like investors, out of the market. Because, I mean, like the US dollar definitely is an attraction for Cambodia, right? People come to Cambodia because it's a dollarized economy. They can invest in dollars and they can get their return in US dollars. So it's a currency hedge, right? Or no currency hedge needed, basically. But long term, I definitely think the government wants to increase the amount of Khmer real in circulation, and that ratio, as I said, it's currently around 12% in the financial sector, and the real economy, I believe it's around 20%. So they definitely want to increase that. Again, that gives them leverage and more monetary power to actually control things and print their own money. But I think they're going to do this very gradually. So the NBC and the government, they know very well that like doing this too quick would just cause ripple effects in the economy, which would not be healthy. And like Vietnam has done that, and now you're paying, like we have 4,000 real to a dollar, and I don't know the exact number for Vietnam right now, but yeah, you talk millions, right? So that mm-hmm. would be absolutely detrimental to Cambodia if that would happen. So I believe like they do want to go from 12% of the financial sector to 20%, but this will probably take another 5 years, maybe 10 even, but yes.
Okay. And maybe just segueing to your then transition outside of the Association of Banks and actually going and working with one of the largest groups in the country, Royal Group. What was that like, that transition and moving over to like a more of a large corporate setting?
Yeah, definitely a lot more corporate. That's definitely a key word. But it was funny enough. The day I left was the 31st of November. And the day I started at ABC was 1st December. So it was literally on the day 5 years, which I spent at ABC. Basically public sector, right? Representing, working for the private sector, representing the banks, but in a public sector function in terms of representing those banking interests to the government. That's what I did for 5 years. So to some extent, the transition came naturally, as like a lot of the Royal Group players were not unknown to me. Like Royal Group is a huge player in the financial sector as well, with owning Wing 100% and owning J-Trust to a large share, Royal J-Trust. So already knew a lot of people inside Royal Group, and hence it wasn't stepping into the unknown, really, right? It was a very slow and smooth transmission in that sense. But yeah, a lot more corporate, a lot more less political to some extent. I said earlier, one of the biggest learning curves I had was the cultural learning curve, and that also translate to how to behave in terms of politics a little bit, right? And I now had less of it inside the Royal Group, but it's still an asset to know how to deal with etiquette, to know the etiquette. But now in a more corporate world, real private sector. I'm not as much like private public sector involved anymore as before. So I think, like, you mentioned it yourself, the keyboard is just, it's a lot more corporate now. But instead, like, the nice thing to myself, a real thing I really enjoy, and I really laugh at my job at Royal Group now, is that instead of just sitting at the sidelines and watching the opportunities and watching this intense growth of Cambodia and just helping the banks in getting there, I'm now actually have the ability and have a chance to be part of this growth and these opportunities. I mean, we will talk later about RGX and some other projects I'm working on, but like having this ability to actually work on 5 projects at the same time and really being part of that process in the real economy and the real private sector, that's something I never had before. And that's like absolute beautiful thing about working with a large conglomerate like that in the private sector. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, that brings us to our next topic. You know, Dom and I on Rising Giants is being focused on startups and innovation, fintech and digital assets, crypto, whatever you want to call it, has been a topic that keeps coming up. And I think something where Cambodia, the adoption rates are actually quite high in comparison to other countries. Hmm. And so I'd be curious to hear more about how RGX came together, the first licensed crypto exchange or digital asset exchange in Cambodia. So yeah, how did that get going for you?
Yeah. So yeah, you pointed out already, I mean, demand is there, the community is already there. Crypto by nature is decentralized, right? It's a decentralized technology and hence has reached every human in the world, basically. I think the last number I saw is that there are like around 200 million crypto wallets or digital asset wallets around the world at this point. And like, there's not a single country in this world where wouldn't be one, right? So Cambodia is, as like the numbers we know from Binance, which is the biggest existing platform people use in Cambodia, is that there's around 200,000 Cambodian wallets on Binance, and they all currently they use P2P. So the market is already there. So how did RGX come into play was a bit, we said like for several years, the banking sector actually has been banned by the NBC to deal with any crypto businesses. So until now, nobody actually got any license or no regulated digital asset market has actually sprung up yet. So this is RGX being the first one, is a new one. And we have worked with a regulator, specifically SCSC, over the last year to come up with a form which is acceptable to the government, which is safe to the Cambodian users, and which will help the country in developing the country and while protecting and being a safe environment for investors. I think one of the key things for RGX is to educate the Cambodians and to help understanding this new realm of digital assets. In reality, this is also why crypto was banned in the first place in Cambodia, because of the fear that people get scammed and people gamble their money away. And those are completely justifiable arguments in order to ban it. But I mean, the reality is just with that kind of technology, you cannot ban people from actually using it. I mean, while it being banned from the banks, basically, you still have 200,000 people buying and selling crypto every day on Binance. And they do it via their banks, no doubt. I mean, via P2P. The question is now, like, if you regulate it, do you put it in a safer space? If you don't regulate it, you give open doors to people, scamming people and issuing like totally unvaluable tokens, etc. So that's how we started RGX with the intention to build a platform for Cambodians, which is here, which is regulated, which is safe, and which will help the country developing in terms of digitization, which is one of the prime goals of the government right now. Yeah.
So just touching on the P2P side, which is very popular for the likes of Binance, will you also have that functionality in order for people to kind of on-ramp and off-ramp? Because currently you can't do a direct interaction between a crypto exchange and a bank.
Yes. Yeah, 100%. So this is also our next plan, is to launch P2P. enabling just the users to trade with each other. Still monitored in terms of from the platform, and everything is going to be reported, monitored by SCSC. And we're still going to adhere to anti-money laundering laws and KYC, etc. But yeah, P2P is the next step we are launching as well to enable users to actually on-off-ramp fiat into the digital asset world. Yeah.
And just to put it into perspective, so the fact that Binance have 200,000 users in Cambodia, how would that compare to like a bank, for example? Like how many customers does the average bank have in Cambodia? Yeah.
The average bank would have to do some math now, but I think there's around 2.4 million bank accounts, something like this, right? Yeah. Right now, I believe, yeah. Or loan accounts, actually. I think bank accounts there's more. So there's actually two million something loan accounts. So yeah, you divide that by, I believe, like 60 banks right now. So yeah, 40,000 or something like that.
Yeah.
So that's your average bank. Yeah. So yeah.
I know there are some countries in Africa where I was looking at some statistics the other day, and there was actually more Binance accounts than the total bank accounts in the country.
Yeah.
Which is crazy.
Yeah. That's not the case here. But I mean, we often like a joke in the tech sector here is often that over like the total like sign of digitization and the youth of Cambodia being so tech affinity, the number of Facebook accounts, right? So there's, I believe, there's 10 million Facebook accounts in Cambodia. And that's like nearly double. I believe like, so saving accounts in the banking sector, I think it's like 4 or 5 million or so. But yeah, I would have to check that. It's around there. So like the fun fact is just like there's more Facebook accounts than formal banking accounts in Cambodia. And that, yeah. So this shows how digital the youth is and still unformalized to some extent. For crypto, that's not the case yet. So currently there's 200,000 accounts, a lot less than the banking sector, and nothing compared to 10 million Facebook accounts.
Mm, okay. So in comparison to like Binance or other centralized exchanges, what has been your kind of asset criteria? What are you going to be listing on the platform, and what's the reason for that? And are those specific kind of top tier assets, or how do you think about that?
Yeah, so we launched around 180 spot pairings. So basically, those are the 180 top traded tokens and coins around the world. So the biggest ones, which are proven not to be scams, basically. How we gonna like further adopt coins or list coins or tokens or potentially even NFTs later on, we'll have a process for that. And the test we made very clear is that we have to see sense in any project. So we already got a lot of requests by individuals, can I list my token? And eventually we will be enabling that people can, or projects can be listed theoretically, but we will not allow individuals to randomly list their tokens and or random projects. So there will be a lot of scrutiny on that they are licensed businesses who want to issue for a certain project. And everything we're going to list, also the 180 assets we have listed already, everything has to be approved by the regulator, the SCSC, the Security Exchange Regulator. So down the road, said we plan to enable that, and we want RGX to be a platform also for Cambodian businesses to raise capital. Also, maybe for ourselves, I've said it in some other interviews, that we thinking about asset tokenization, basically tokenizing land or like real estate in general. But that's down the road, and everything has to go hand in hand with the regulator, with scrutiny, to make sure that investors' capital is being safely kept and money is actually going towards the right projects.
Mm, okay. And so if your main metric is kind of trading volume as of now, so you said that 180 top assets by trading volume, are there also like some assets within there that would be like meme coins, for example, like these kinds of things that maybe don't have that much utility and are based on purely on sentiment and memetics, right? I'm curious, like, if you'd screen some of those out, or if you just let the market decide and it's by trading volume.
No, at this point we basically let the market decide. So we the 180 listings are the 180 most popular in the world. So that includes a lot of meme coins as well. So yeah, you can buy Dogecoin or you can trade Dogecoin on RGX.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't like, there is probably not much real value behind it in terms of projects. But I mean, that's the fun thing is like, that's often the argument with crypto and digital assets in general, right? Oh, it doesn't have any value in the back. But I mean, that's the same thing for fiat as well, right? The fiat, you have a government promising it has value. And that's the beautiful thing about decentralized blockchain is, I mean, it's not the government, but it's a community. So to me, digital assets and the blockchain by design is the most democratic thing in the world. Like it's by nature, totally democratic. So Dogecoin, yes, probably for example, as we take this as an example, or any meme coin, potentially, if like millions of people decide this has value to them, like who would anybody be to say it has not value, right? Because I mean, if some government tells me that their currency has value, then so be it. But if 10 million people come together and say their stuff has value, then I think they have the same right to do that.
That's it. No, that's a good way to think about it. What would you say some of the challenges have been to kind of communicating the message and differentiating yourself from like the likes of a Binance? What are you going to be focusing on to get people to see you as like it's a different offering?
Yeah. Oh, that question came up a lot also from the community, the existing community, why RGX over Binance, right? Like they, like 200,000 Cambodians are already happily on Binance and they've been doing this for 5 years plus. So why go to RGX? I think like as previously as you asked, what we're going to list, we're going to have a lot of scrutiny, like what's going to be listed. So we won't open the gate for anything to be listed. That's one thing, which is security and anti-scam for the user. But I think the most important thing, especially for Cambodia, is like we are a local entity with local support. So our page is in Khmer. The app, which we're going to launch very soon, we already have the app. We're just waiting for them to go live on the App Store on Apple and Google. They're going to be in Khmer. The website is in Khmer. And we have a local support. So people can come, send email, or the hotline we are going to install very soon will have Khmer's helping the users to solve their problems. So I literally made the example with like people asking me directly at our last event as well. So what happens if, so you're using Binance, what happens if you lose a password, right? And you have to send an email to Binance support. Like, it will take you 3 weeks at best to get something like that resolved and like if they even respond to you. And let alone if you have problems communicating in English, if you only speak Khmer, so you are basically pretty much screwed and like your assets like might be lost. So with RGX now being here locally, so we literally eventually will open our doors where people can come to our office and there will be like a support desk. And also people can call the number and speak in Khmer and we can resolve issues very quickly. So that's the thing. Just that's having that safety of having a local exchange rather than something out there in the web only. And then really we want to build that community. So we the plan is to have events now from every month. We want to do something every month, build a community of followers, build a community of enthusiasts in the space. And have built them a platform to come together, talk to each other, to learn from each other, and like educating the people, which also again, like that's actually makes the whole blockchain space safe, right? Having the people educated, do your own research, learn what this whole thing is about, and this is how you stay safe as well. And that's like you can't do that without a local entity, really. And I think that's what makes RGX so important and like really distinguish itself from anything else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That I think commitment that's, to. Sorry. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Max.
No. Back to you.
Just was going to make a quick comment saying that commitment to having customer centricity, right? You're focusing on making sure that, you know, the customer experience and building that community is front and center. So it's really important, especially with RGX's mission. So I'm curious to just understand as well what a process would be like for a user to onboard and kind of what is that timeline for them to be able to be activated and start trading too?
Okay, so a normal user journey would be, you go currently, again, we haven't launched the app yet, so currently it's only on the website. But yeah, you go on rgxtrade.com, you type in your email, create a password, we will put in your phone number, we will send a verification code to your phone immediately. So you verify this is your phone number, you verify your email, and then the account is basically created. The next step then to actually be able to actively trade, withdraw and deposit, is then to go through to verification process, meaning KYC. And for KYC, you take a selfie, you take a picture of your passport or ID card, and that's basically it. And that process of verifying your KYC in most use cases takes around 10, 20 minutes. There's always, so we had issues for in individual cases, literally individual cases. So maybe it's like 2-3 cases out of 100 have a problem. For like 98 cases out of 100, it takes 10 minutes, it's done. For 2 out of 100, it's they use a VPN, they don't take a selfie, they upload a picture which they already had on their computer and that's cropped or something. They upload a picture of their passport, which was edited, just because the contrast was increased, something like this. Like those things, if they not been live, like if those are not live pictures, then the KYC won't go through. But yeah, for 98% of cases, within 15 minutes, you have a verified account on RTX.
Yeah, I've always been curious about the KYC process on the back end. How that actually is processed and how that actually works.
Yeah,
it would be so great to.
Yeah, sure. So we use an international third party because also we would have loved to work with the local entity CamDX here as well. Or also, I mean, as part of Royal Group, Wing Bank has also developed their own KYC, which we could have used. But to be internationally accepted from Chain Analysis and other partners we use in order to build the exchange, we actually needed to use internationally recognized, globally recognized KYC system. So the system we use has a database of blacklisted names. So it's basically this what the system does is it verifies liveliness, it verifies the similarity of your selfie with an ID card. So it actually checks that it's a real ID card. It checks you're a real person. It checks that you look the same, etc. So basically verifying you as a person. And then the next step is it will check that, counter-check this with sanction lists, sanction countries, etc., making sure that you are not on any sanctioned list or that you are not based in North Korea, like things like this, right? So this is basically how the backend works on the backend. The KYC works on the backend. And this whole process is automated. That's why it's able to run only like 10 minutes.
Okay. And just a bit of a bit off topic, but we've seen the Bitcoin ETF get approved. So over 30 billion now in AUM. I'm curious if you also see a sort of a focus of RGX over the coming years to also focus more on like the B2B side. So whereby you could be a custody partner for businesses that maybe want to hold Bitcoin on their balance sheet, or for in the case that an ETF gets approved in Cambodia. So I just wonder if that's like the agenda.
Yeah, interesting question. So currently it's not truly on the agenda. Sure is an option. Like currently RGX will definitely enable businesses or like so individual businessmen, right, to put part of a balance sheet in Bitcoin. So you can buy Bitcoin on RGX, right? So that definitely would be a possibility. In terms of issuing a fund or like an ETF, I think currently the market is not big enough and it's not ripe enough for actually doing that. So yeah, I don't think there's enough businesses right now who would be interested in doing so to make that worthwhile endeavor. So yeah, it's not really on the agenda right now, not in the short, not in the medium term, maybe in the long term. Short, medium term is building the existing community out, educating the community and building an actually blockchain affinity, blockchain understanding community of Cambodians. So getting vet first before you actually start selling ETFs to the corporates. Yeah.
Hmm. Okay. And now that we're kind of, I mean, from your side, I'm someone that probably understands like the macro shift that's going on and interest rates, let's say peaking and more moving into an easing cycle. Would you say that's like a leading indicator for the crypto market in general to outperform in 2024, risk assets in general, as we kind of shift into a more easing environment?
Yes. Yeah, very true. Recently the government seemed to step away from further interest hikes. And so next step is probably interest rates will go down. And in the past, this would have if it goes that much down, and maybe it even leads to quantitative easing, that in the past has definitely fueled bull runs. So a lot of it newly printed money, or a lot of like easy money, cheap money from the banks, would go into crypto historically, 100%. And like one other thing right now happening this year is the halving of Bitcoin again, which again also historically has led into bull runs. So yes, 2024 definitely would be primed for an upward market for digital assets and to outperform traditional securities, traditional equity market, stock market, etc. Yes, I very much believe so. That said, I'm also, as RGX, we want to be a market enabler and market maker. I don't necessarily want to give financial advice in terms of invest, we're going to be a bull market. I don't know. Nobody really knows. But the market and all the environment is definitely primed for one. Yes.
And just one other thing that we haven't touched on. How did you go about like building your team? And maybe that could give us some perspective on like the developer talent here. So the people that you've been working with to actually build RGX. Are you working with a lot of Kamai's software engineers on this? What's that been like?
Yeah. So we are building a Kamai team, and we have a Kamai team. But to be fair, the team is learning as we go as well on a lot of the blockchain aspects. So the actual exchange was built by Xcodes, our tech partner on that project, which is based from Mongolia. They run the biggest exchange in Mongolia. They run the exchange in Kazakhstan, one in the Philippines, and now Cambodia. So they know what they're doing security-wise, safety-wise. We actually, inside Royal Group, we have developers as well, and we have a lot of coders and a lot of really tech-savvy people inside some of our subsidiaries as well. And we were actually able to build a full exchange in-house as well. But we're just also, with a commitment and the security for users, we didn't want to come out of the blue with something we just built ourselves. Because like, to be fair, we don't have experience here locally, Royal Group. We don't have the experience to run a full-on blockchain exchange and guaranteeing people that it's safe, right? So that's why we actually teamed up with Xcodes as a tech partner to have that extra safety for that. Like, the exchange we are providing now is absolutely top-notch international standard. And we have a lot of talent here, and like we're building a really good team under RGX, and like we have really good coders inside Royal Group. But yeah, we still could not promise users to have this top-notch international exchange, because yeah, it's the first one of Cambodia, right? So we did get some help from outside as well. Yeah.
Thank you for talking through RGX with us and giving us a full perspective there. It's really interesting, and we're super excited to see what is going to be rolled out in the coming months, and being able to hopefully see the continued developments. Heading into our last section of the podcast, we just want to talk to you about a couple of things to know a little bit more about yourself. And I think the first one is there anybody that specifically within the crypto space that you look up to? That you know, with RGX, there's some of the, you know, maybe a Brian Armstrong, for example, or any other developers there out there that you feel like have influenced your commitment to building in the space?
It's not so much the individuals. I mean, I think there definitely are some individuals who step out, like Vitalik from Ethereum is like one of the most genius people on the planet, probably. He often reminds me a little bit of Stephen Hawking, like being just really, really smart. I definitely admire like those kind of individuals. But I think the beauty for me, and it's like what I love so much about the space, the blockchain space, is the decentralized part in nature, right? That's again reinforcing what I said earlier with like, where's the value in blockchain? The value is not the one individual building it. It's the value is that 10 million people believe in it, right? Or like as earlier said, if you look at the whole space, it's 200 million people who now use crypto blockchain. So again, like, who are you, even like governments telling me it doesn't have value, if 200 million people say it has value? And I mean, 200 million people, that's quite a sizable country, right, in itself. So that's what I think is, So in the individuals, like I said, Vitalik from Ethereum is really into, if people really are into blockchain and want to learn about it, he has a blog and he writes published article all the time, which are really technical and really interesting, what he thinks is the future of blockchain. So that's really something cool to look into. Then obviously, if you look more on the influencer side, I mean, Elon Musk is the big guy, right? And again, if I further want to go on that topic in terms of the value of Dogecoin, yeah, I mean, there is no intrinsic value by itself, but there's millions of people believing in it. And now you can actually pay Tesla buy a car with it, right? So if you say Dogecoin doesn't have value, I mean, you're also saying a Tesla car doesn't have value, right? It's a, you know, So he is not the genius who building blockchain. He's a genius building rockets and cars. But I think he did a lot for the space by supporting it and actually being outspoken about it. So that's, yeah, I think very mentionable in that space as well. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's funny that you mentioned that because Max has read the recent biography. I'm actually currently going through it too, and I'm not sure if you've had a chance to read it as well. But it's very interesting just to see, especially. You almost forget to, you know, post PayPal days, like SpaceX and Tesla have been around for quite a while. We're talking early mid 2000s. So just understanding how in the early days, how he was running those businesses and at what, I guess, demanding, like how demanding it was. It's fascinating. But, you know, on the other end of it, it's, you need almost that outlier of an individual to really push forward that kind of like technology development and different way of thinking. So yeah, he's definitely someone worth like learning from and reading about too, in terms of perspectives. Speaking of that as well, are there any books that have influenced the way that you've maybe gone about your personal life or business life, or that you just think is a good read in general?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Always a good question about books. Yeah, I haven't read the Elon Musk one, so definitely I'm going to look into. So I'm a firm believer for myself, at least, that if I read, when I read, I have to read a lot for work, obviously. And when I read in my private time, I also want to learn something. So I only read nonfiction books. I don't read any fiction books, never. If I want to be entertained, I watch a movie. So, but yeah, my favorite author is probably Michael Lewis. He writes all about finance and economics. The most entertaining book from him is Flash Boys. So if not read that, or maybe you have, then So it's really entertaining how it's actually a really bad story, and it's really reflecting on the modern finance system of on the stock market, and how front runners are actually skimming like little pennies off every trade, and thereby like basically stealing from your average retail trader. So, but it's so entertaining written, and a lot of his books are. So Michael Lewis is definitely one of my favorite writer. Another book which I think hugely influenced me, and I think I was maybe 13 or something whenever first time I read it, is Siddhartha. It's basically about Buddha. So Siddhartha is the original name of Buddha, and the book describes how he became Buddha, basically. So how he travels, like he as a prince, how he left his home and travels through the world and finds like his values and his principles. Like he just knew like he doesn't fit in as a prince. And then, right, experience that makes all this experience and eventually ends up to become Buddha, basically. And that was like actually my teacher at the time. Everybody in class had to read one book, and so he would assign a book to every student. And yeah, I got Siddhartha, and I had to read that book. And as I said earlier, I maybe was a little bit of a wild teenager. So it definitely made a big impression on me how this guy was, how Siddhartha was a prince sitting there and didn't know what to do with his life. And traveled the world to find out what to do. So, I mean, I definitely don't want to compare myself to Buddha, but I thought that is a good approach to look up to. So, yeah, definitely put me into traveling. Yeah,
oddly enough, can see the correlation there just slightly. Yeah. So, you know, speaking of traveling, you mentioned a lot about how you love to hike and love to explore, and especially doing solo traveling. Myself, actually. And the same way too. And I'm curious, just where have you been in nature around the world, whether that's a hike, a trek, whatever it may be, that you felt like is a must experience? And then on the other end, where's somewhere in the world that you are excited to get to at some point?
So one thing I did here in the area was Rinjani on Lombok next to Bali. I think a lot of people travel to Bali anyway. Some of them go to Lombok, and even fewer of them actually do Rinjani. And it's I think the second highest mountain of Asia or Southeast Asia. Really cool. Like literally you can camp over the clouds, and then you have this crater. Super impressive and just beautiful. I mean, Indonesia in general is beautiful. So green and crystal clear water around it. Absolutely beautiful. Another thing for all Europeans, Morocco is a complete different world from Europe, but it's just 45 minutes away or 2 hours, depending where you are in Europe. And Mount Toubkal. So Mount Toubkal is the highest mountain of North Africa. Also like super cool. And if somebody wants to challenge themselves a little bit and just go and do a solo hike to Mount Toubkal, and you go the one way up, just fly to Marrakesh, go down one or 2 hours down to the beginning of Atlas Mountains. You hike Mount Toubkal and you go down to the other side, and you basically you finish off near the Sahara. And yeah, seeing like going basically through different weather climates all in like 2-3 days. It's really cool. Like you have on top of Mount Toubkal over 4,000 meters, you have snow, and like you basically finish your hike like near the Sahara at like 30 degrees. It's really fucking cool. Here in Cambodia, what I love, I go camping a lot. I take my dog out a lot. I like a beginning of COVID, actually, I bought a very old Toyota and built that out to like an off-road car. And I love going out, take my dog and just hang out and go one or two nights to Kiri Rom and sleep under the trees, under the stars. And yeah, that's like really like calming me down and chilling. And it's so good. Those are the times I get to eat my German bratwurst. So just take a couple beers. Often I take a friend with me, just some beers and German bratwurst. The dog can run around in the forest. Everybody's happy, you know, and you can just forget about everything which happens at work. So yeah, I really enjoy that. And yeah, and Kiri Rom is just 2 hours away from Phnom Penh. So yeah, my second home out of a city, basically. Yeah, but like if you stay in Cambodia, I think Koh Kong, the Cardamom Mountains are just incredible. There's also very beautiful areas in Ratanakiri and Stang Treng, and El Previ here, absolute gorgeous. But yeah, those are not day trips. You can't do that on a weekend from Phnom Penh, sadly. So it's like really nice now they're building the expressway to Siem Reap. So currently it takes you, 5-6 hours to go to Siem Reap. Once there's an expressway, you may get there in 2 or 3, like probably 3 hours. Then you can actually do it for a weekend. So I'm really looking forward to that. And you can actually go just for 1 or 2 nights and go see Angkor Wat. That's going to be really cool. Currently, I'm basically limited to Kiri Rom, which I totally love. But yeah, I'm looking forward while the infrastructure in Cambodia improves, that you get more options where to go in quickly for a weekend. Because yeah.
Do you also work on a Saturday?
No. I'm very lucky. I'm lucky enough that I don't. Yeah. Sometimes we do. So if you have an event, we sometimes work Saturdays and also Sundays. So, and like, yeah, my phone might also always ring. Often also like well, funnily, my chairman has the talent to always call me on Saturdays when I'm camping. So, yeah, but so basically officially I don't work on Saturdays, Sundays. So I get my weekends off. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the whole like, sorry, I can't hear you, bad connection.
Oh, okay. Whenever he calls.
Yeah.
The traditional closing question that we like to ask each of our guests is, what's the best piece of advice that you've ever been given?
Best piece of advice, I would think travel, experience, and don't judge people too quickly. Just like, everybody is different, and what I've seen in their environment, people are not bad. We are all children of our environment. But also don't run after like certain goals, but just like find something which you think is cool, interests you. Like that's the most, people always say, find something which makes you happy and do follow your passion. I do think you have to compromise. So you definitely have to compromise in life. Not everybody can follow their dream, sadly not. But definitely don't do something you hate just to get a bigger TV and a bigger car. So find something you like and find something you're good at. And then, yeah, try to build your own character and your own skill set around certain things. Yeah.
Oh, great. Well, again, thank you, Thomas, for coming on to Rising Giants today. It was really great to talk to you about your background, about everything that you're working on. And yeah, look forward to chatting soon.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Max. Yeah. Pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Thank you very much. You.